Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is episode 3 on the theory of human motivation by Abraham Maslow. To find the text and for more information, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. This episode is brought to you with the support of the Innovation, Knowledge and Organizational Networks Research Center at the University of Warwick. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
This is Pedro, coming to you from Brasilia in Brazil.
This is Ralph, coming to you from Albuquerque, New Mexico in the United States.
And this is Miranda, coming to you from Leamington Spa in the UK.
Welcome, everybody. So this time we're going to discuss a text somewhat different from the ones we did in episode 1 and 2 on Taylor and Fayol. One of the reasons we're reading Maslow this time is in part because the two aforementioned giants of management theory consistently spoke of human motivation and generally what it is that makes their employees tick. And because of that, it seemed only appropriate to read this particular text, especially given its canonical significance, not just in management, but overall. I think I'm still unsure about my experiences of the reading, but there are a couple of things I'd like to mention before we talk about this. One is that for me it was somewhat difficult to get through this particular reading because it's so self-contained and doesn't really lend much room for deliberation, but granted that's probably because I prefer more contemplative work. And the other is that I was struggling a little bit to come up with discussion points for this one. So in preparation for this episode, I went and listened to a couple of podcasts on Maslow, which didn't really help much, primarily because they ended up being quite surface level. So I hope we can go a bit more in depth today, because it really seems that Maslow has been pretty much reduced to that pyramid of his, which is unfortunate. But anyway, what did you make of the reading?
Well, I was very, very excited in some parts, and especially to discover that he has a very acute point about people, in which he seems to see humans in a almost like composite, layered way, which is very interesting. And he, although he's a psychologist, he's a very strong social perspective. And he, you know, the discussion about the importance of esteem and self-actualization and all these more social components, which is something that I did not expect, and I think that's still very relevant in light to current discussions in economics or cognitive science even, that are very present in business schools. But I was a bit surprised that given the impact that this text and Maslow's ideas have, I was expecting for some reason that it would be much more, less dry and more applied. So at times it was hard to me to link the text to many, many ideas that we have now as common sense, which I think that are connected. But I also struggled like you, Dimitri, I think, a bit on that.
The whole dryness of it is what I was referring to.
Yeah.
I think it's quite interesting how there's the full acknowledgement of how human beings can be driven by different kind of needs. But what I really struggle with is this idea of the fact that only once you've fulfilled one level, you can go to the next level. I think it's a bit too automatic, a bit too, I don't know. I don't see it in everyday life, let's put it that way.
Well, I'm not, I think Miranda makes a good point. And I also like the three of you had some difficulty with, not so much the dryness, it's just very few examples from what you would call satisfied people. A lot of the examples were people who have some sort of psychopathology or some, you know, deep-seated problem. And he doesn't, later in the text, he writes about the fact that the levels, you don't have to be 100% satisfied at one level to go to the next. But he said there may be some threshold level that says you have to be 25% of one level, and then maybe you're 5% of the next, or you might be 50% at one level, then 20% at one level, and then 5% of the, you know, the third level, which is all, to me, very speculative. It's he really wasn't offering much evidence, and that kind of goes back to, I think, the dryness and the points you were making, all three of you were making earlier, that it looked to me, as I was reading it, that he's putting this out there as a theory of human motivation based on other data he's accumulated or his personal experience. And because many times in a text he writes that this needs further study or there needs to be further research in this area. So I think looks like he's just putting it out there as here's my opinion or here's what my theory is. And then he's leaving it for others to research. And we can talk about this later, but there's other articles that say there's not a lot of empirical support. So I, like Pedro, am a little surprised how much weight this seems to have in organizational, or at least used to have in organizational science, when there's very little empirical backing for it.
Yeah. So, but what about the things that we did like about the text? What did caught your attention?
Well, for me, the main thing was that he is considerably less rigid than he's made out to be, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I have come to appreciate him more when I did this almost hermeneutical reinterpretation of the text, and that didn't come easy. So as I mentioned, I struggled a bit coming up with discussion points, but I think context in which the hierarchy is to be interpreted is very important. So for instance, and I think we'll speak about this a bit later on, what is the hierarchy geared for? So you have the five levels, and the final one is self-actualization. But what does that mean? So is it self-actualization in this metaphysical way, what it is to, you know, find your purpose as a human being, or is it just finding meaning in your everyday life? And depending on which one you take, and that's one of the things I want to discuss, the whole hierarchy takes on a different appearance.
No, I was just going to say that this is actually very interesting. I was just going to add that I was surprised when I got the text that there was no pyramid drawn in the text. I was like, where's the pyramid?
I think that comes later. And I think Dmitry made a good point about there was quite a bit more nuance in the theory and in the text than what you commonly see excerpted from Maslow, where it's basically here's the levels and here's what people are trying to accomplish and stuff. And he does a lot more what we would say hedging in the text, where he says, okay, here's some indications, and there's some indications that some people, for example, I thought it was really interesting. He was talking about creative people, and he said for some people that motivation to be creative actually overcomes the other level. So it's not quite as hierarchical and strict, because for some people the urge to create, for example, is stronger than some of the more basic needs. So I thought that was interesting, because you don't often see that in the way Maslow is described. So I, like Dmitry, enjoyed the idea that when you read the original text, you get quite a bit more nuance than you get from what's normally transmitted, which is a pity if you think about the way Maslow is normally discussed.
I just want to build quickly on this point of creative people, because that was one of the points, I think, that seems very still contemporary for me, but that I read almost I expanded it. So I don't know if I'm reading too much into the text, but I think he talks about, you know, how people like to be good at the things that they excel, and they wanted to do more of that and things like that. So I imagine that applies to any kind of worker in any kind of company. And in a way, if you want, it's almost like the root of many practices we have today in human resources, like the Ypsilon career, in which you can go up the ladder, not only into the administrative ranks, but also doing more and more specialized work in the kinds of things that I do. I had that in the company study in the product development department. There were people that just became more specialized in the product and made a career out of there. Or even things that are, I don't know how much they are very, they do exist, but they are very popular in the discourse, at least around, of giving 10% of time to people to do their own little projects in companies. So I think that there's some resemblance of that, but I don't know if I'm making a big jump.
I don't think you're making a big jump. I think you do see that in organizations where there's a sort of a growth in expertise and many people. What you see in expertise research is that many of the people who become experts do it as a form of self-actualization. It's what they choose to do. It's their calling, what they're trying to develop themselves into. What I think is interesting about trying to get more building expertise in organizations is a lot of that motivation and drive is comes from the self. It's hard to motivate somebody externally to become an expert. And I think that, so that's because of my interest in expertise studies, I thought that was very interesting. But I think I'm curious if Miranda saw some parallels with what she sees in entrepreneurship and sort of that drive for people to be entrepreneurs, and whether that's creative or something else. So I'm curious what angle she saw.
Well, I think one of the first things that kind of like struck me about this text was that there is this general developmental view, and it's kind of understandable given the context in which Maslow was. So he was son of Jewish immigrants from Russia and in New York of the 1930s. So there is a lot of this like self-made man of developing yourself, of going forward and so on. I also think that a very interesting part of this text is a general emphasis on the importance of sound data, of empirical evidence. So even though the text hasn't really got a lot of empirical confirmation in further subsequent works, the entire author talks a lot about empirical evidence. So I thought that was very important for the field of organization studies in general.
Mm-hmm. What, the evidence part? Can you say more?
I think it's fascinating, as in the case of Taylor, this idea of collecting evidence, of collecting empirical data, and then building the theory. I just like the way it was constructed and the way it's justified to the reader.
Yeah, I think I had this thing, I think, throughout all the texts we have read thus far. I think there's almost like a pendulum that goes one side and the other, in which all these people, they are trying to write... They're writing something completely new in a way. It's very breakthrough because they're creating the field as they write. So in some points, it seems almost they are very welcoming of people putting to proof what they're having to say. And Maslow, I think, is the most explicit about that, in the way that he would welcome more research and more evidence building up on that. But at the same time, it reads very authoritative. It reads very, you know, matter-of-factual. This is the way it is. So it's hard to put these things together. So I don't know if it's a fact of just the early origins, or there's something more in there.
Well, he says here that he is trying to formulate a positive theory, which is probably where the authority comes in. But I'm a bit more skeptical as to the novelty of this framework, particularly because you can see something like that even as far as William James. He had the human factors of material, social, and spiritual. Mm-hmm. And I know that Maslow was certainly reacting to the psychological theories of Freud and Adler. Mm-hmm. So to me, he's very, very similar to Viktor Frankl, in that his theory of motivation is geared towards animating humans as conscious agents searching for their purpose in life, kind of thing, rather than reactive machines that either pursue desire or power, as in the case with Freud and Adler. So in this way, I am a bit more reluctant to give Maslow as much credit in terms of pioneering as we have given to Taylor and Fayol. And I think because of this, I mean, this work covers a lot, as Ralph said. I mean, he gives out an ethical proposition as to when these needs should be met, which is something that never got covered during my experience with Maslow. And he talks about things like child development, and even posits a view of sort of human predisposition in this life, as he says that it's humans are more keen to see rather than to be blind, and they strive for knowledge. But because of this, it's very naive almost that everyone wants to be better and strives towards meaning, and that's not what I see. I mean, as much as I like that in myself and the people around me, it's certainly there is, I think, an active sort of sterilization of the upper levels of this hierarchy going on, not just culturally, but also in organizations.
I think I disagree a bit. Well, first of all, I want to say that I love your customary erudition, but for me, I would boil down the whole thing that Maslow is trying to do is just this radical idea that people are social and they are people, you know, because yes, I agree that he might not be the first one. I don't know enough about the whole history of thought, especially in psychology, to affirm that. But I think he's adding fuel to something very important. I don't know how much, what kind of experiments people were doing back then, but he refers to this thing that, you know, we should not treat humans as animals and research done in grad do not apply. And if you think about it, still today, there is so much research in business school related to, you know, behavior science or cognitive psychology or anything like that, that still try to boil down everything to just this internal trait and comparing, you know, like, think just about, you know, neuroscience and how it's becoming more popular in business schools. So I think he has a very, I know, almost like a historical important voice in that period to try to expand this idea of seeing humans as, in a way, as social, or maybe just as a sociologist in me.
No, he does that. I don't think he is contesting theories of that would normally guide behavioral or, well, basically the positivistic theory of cognition.
Mm-hmm.
He's saying that, okay, the two of those are valid, and I'm just going to propose something more higher purpose oriented, because meaning is not something that can be determined through experiments, right?
Mm-hmm.
The self-actualization is, I think, deeply personal in many ways.
Well, and I think, so the two things that he added, I think, that were new were this, the fact that the needs are in a hierarchy, right? That you start at the more basic needs and then you would work your way up, which I think is interesting, but even he hedges that later and talks about percentages and, you know, and gives actual, you know, numbers, which I think is a bit of a stretch because he really has no data or basis for saying that, but it's not a bad theory. I mean, I'm not sure I'm the right one to judge, but I thought that was all right. And then I think we've been talking about this several times, so I'll just review it briefly. And this idea of self-actualization, you know, this idea that whether it's to become the best person you can be at some particular skill or best sort of human being, I think that goes beyond James and Mead and those who are talking about personality, where Maslow is talking about this higher purpose that people may have. But I was going to ask Dimitri to explain, although I'll try to say what I think you meant when you said it's sort of sterile at the higher levels, and then you can help me if I got it wrong. But I also thought, it gets a little flat up there where you're not quite sure, well, how does that work? And why do some people actually pursue the higher levels? I mean, Maslow seems to take it for granted. Maybe that's not the best way to say it, but he seems to assume that when the more basic needs are met or fulfilled, people are going to step into that, be more conscious of the higher levels or the self-actualization of that purpose in life. And I wonder, because like Pedro, that I don't see that in organizations, that not everybody is actually searching for that sort of higher sense of self, or at least it's not visible. Maybe they are, or maybe they channel it into, you don't see it in organizations, you see it elsewhere. And I think that's one of the interesting things about some of the modern organizations where people are trying to tap into that desire for self-actualization actually at the workplace. So Pedro gave the example of companies that let you have 10% or 20% of your time to work on entrepreneurial kinds of ideas. And there are other organizations that basically, like I think Zappos is one, where they try to tap into people's inner sense of what's important, either through the organization's mission or things where the people can actually feel like they're becoming better. But I don't, my understanding, that's not widespread across the workplace. That's actually, those are kind of islands of innovation that you see.
Right, that's excellent summary and build upon on what I was saying. So when I said sterile, I didn't mean sterile in what he proposed, but as you did get to that, sterile in a way that empirically people don't automatically reach for the higher level. And here it does come through, and that little thing I said about he assumes for the purpose of building this theory that individuals want to know. And from this it follows that the things that prevent people from going in this almost idyllic search for knowledge and virtue is, you know, food and sex and safety. And if those can be satisfied, the trajectory can be maintained. And from this, I'm thinking of Google headquarters in California, you know, where they have free food and recreation and all that stuff. It doesn't, I mean, if that were so, wouldn't everyone there be a virtuous sage? But that's not the case, and it's not the case in organizations, that there is more to achieving these higher levels. And Maslow did acknowledge this himself, because he said that only about 2% of population will ever achieve self-actualization. Now, it wasn't clear whether that's because of the support structure that would allow them to climb the hierarchy, but I think it's simply because it's not the satisfaction of needs that gets someone up there. And
well, certainly not the mere satisfaction, right? Not just having those
I mean, as he proceeds to build this theory, he gradually divorces it from this mechanistic satisfying levels thing that he's sort of been reduced to mainly in most of management theory. And he does say, as I think Miranda mentioned, that you can have percentages and mixes of satisfying different levels. And then he even says that, to Ralph's point on creativity, that some people may trade levels off, and a creative drive may be maybe stronger than a basic need for, you know, these really passionate artists. Mm-hmm. Basically, I think one of the reasons why the pyramid isn't here is because it would have been even worse for his legacy, that someone already drew it and it's sort of categorized him in this step-by-step thing. But I think he realizes in search of meaning, there is more to satisfying the four levels and then reaching the top level and winning the game anyway. And another point, and then I'll shut up, is that in organizations, I would be extremely surprised if an ideal employee for every organization would be a self-actualized human being. We read Taylor and Fayol, and especially Taylor. He is extremely satisfied with employees staying at the very basic level. There is no desire to self-actualize employees. And even thinking of knowledge workers, I'm skeptical as to whether a knowledge worker needs to be as self-actualized. That I think one or two levels up the pyramid is probably sufficient for most organizational need satisfaction.
I want to comment in that last point, because it really got me. I think that maybe Taylor and Maslow have clearly a different position on motivation in humans, but I wonder if that comes from different contexts, because Taylor was dealing with people in, if you will, like a lower level in socioeconomic status, which would fit somehow the idea of Maslow that, you know, more basic things are very important because there are people, you know, they really work for a living. They really need that money, you know, it's very basic. Whereas Maslow would speak more to other situations, exactly the case of, you know, knowledge workers, you know, professionals and these kind of things, in which having money, in a way, is something that, you know, they are probably, these people are born in like in a more middle class status and they do jobs that you're practically, you know, placed in a certain level in society and, you know, you have all these things covered. So, see, I'm trying to say, it might be a function of, you know, different contexts they're speaking to.
I don't know if it is, because Maslow does say that the levels in the extreme sense function only, it is, I think he has this famous phrase that a man lives for bread when there is no bread, or something like that.
That's his line. I thought that was very good.
Perhaps for Taylor that was more the case than for Maslow, and I'm really not informed enough about which audience Maslow was addressing. But I think in societies that we live now, you would be pressed to find employees who would be at such an extreme level of deprivation so as to have the basic need at 100% requirement.
I was just thinking that maybe the difference is that Taylor was an engineer and was looking at work. So he was looking at industries and factories and workers in there. Mm-hmm. But Maslow was a psychologist. So yes. I think his aim was to look at life in general. But what his theory has actually overlooked and has lost during the way when it got to organization studies is that the hierarchy of human needs cannot really be the same in all contexts. So,
yes.
I don't know. It's an aspect that I struggle with because, yes, his intent was to get to the general audience and to general context, but maybe in the work context, it's actually quite different, and maybe with different specific kinds of work, it's even more different. So,
if you just to, I mean, he doesn't even talk so much about work in the text.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, you know,
we took it from there.
I think it's a great observation, Miranda, that that the context differences is really missing, because he's, well, and perhaps it's by design because he talks about coming up with a general theory, but I certainly felt a bit unsatisfied because of that lack of context. He kind of hints at the complexity in part three of the mm-hmm. of the paper, where he talks about there could be cultural differences. There may be, some. I don't know if he used the word context, but he does talk about how the context could be different. So I find it interesting that this has been so widely applied to organizational theory and is considered a seminal text, which I'm sure it is, or I know it is, and yet the work context is absent. So it's been left for people later to kind of read this into work context. So I think maybe that wasn't what his purpose was, but I think Miranda makes a really good point that, and my addition to that would be cultural differences. He just barely hints that there might be cultural differences in the hierarchy or the way people satisfy their basic needs. And I think there's a lot of differences there in cultural context. Mm-hmm.
So can I ask something?
Yeah.
Do you think when we took Maslow from a general psychology field and we brought it into organization studies, should we kind of have we made a mistake? Have we lost things along the way? Have we forgotten to include details? I don't know.
I really think so.
Me too. I think that there's this sort of the nuances. Remember, we were talking about how the way Maslow is presented is often not with this mm-hmm. level of sophistication or these kind of extra ideas. And I think when Maslow, he actually does talk about how behavior and is and actions are multi-determined. So there can be many reasons for for actions that people take. So I just think perhaps it's a bit simplistic to say, well, here's this sort of one idea of stages, and this is and apply too broadly or without that understanding that Miranda was talking about, where there's context differences. Because I think we've been talking about that, about, Taylor looked at work from a strictly procedural, structural point of view. And then Maslow is looking mm-hmm. at needs, translation, and the motivations. I wouldn't say that either one is wrong. I just think the picture is incomplete, and that's why it's good to look at all of those kinds of views.
Well, I think it's actually hard to imagine how we would translate it to organization studies differently, because he was very vague and he was talking more, as Miranda said, general well-being, not so much at motivation at work. But one thing that I think bothers me a bit is that, as I was reading and I was listening to the comments of you all and thinking, I think that the main key point is not necessarily the whole pyramid thing, but what he's trying to say is that there is a difference in kind, not only a difference in degree as people progress in life and progress at their work and progress in what they do, which is very powerful if you think about it, because, we take for granted that, of course, people not only work for money and just paying is not enough. And if you even know it's the most canonical HRM text, I'm sure they were talking about different kind of benefits that go beyond, from having a corner office to having a position that you'd interact with more people and have more responsibility. But I think that was very powerful back then to say this thing that there is a qualitative difference, that you cannot give the same more of the same. You have to give something different.
I broadly agree, but I think maybe there is a reason to look at this in terms of what kind of organizations mm-hmm. is this suited for. Because on an everyday basis, pretty much everything above safety is not concern of the workplace. Things like self-actualization and love is often explicitly prohibited in the workplace. So that doesn't necessarily apply to organizations. And so we're left with the two basic levels. And, that doesn't, I think to Miranda's point, that possibly confuses things more than it helps. But what about, and here I'd like to draw on Ralph's experience, what about organizations where employees spend all of their time in? So in the military or
Go
ahead, Pedro, and then
I really want to hear what Ralph has to say. I want to interrupt that I disagree with this idea of love, because I think you can read that in a way as love for work, or I don't know, there is this famous text that compare leadership to seduction and admiration and all these kind of things. So in a way, when you embrace and you get to a certain position, people want to be admired for what they do. So I think there can be a connection. You don't have to interpret love as loving a person directly.
Love here he said, is human companionship and this intimate connection.
Right.
Whereas, and we probably should come back to this, but when you said about corner offices and getting higher positions and admiration, that's more, to me, that's more Adler. That's more need for power and that sort of thing. But, you know, let's make a note and come back.
So let me start by connecting with what you two just said, and then I can give you my perspective on the military aspect of it. I think both Pedro and Dimitri make really good points. What's next in the hierarchy are esteem needs, so I really agree with Dimitri here. And for Pedro, some of that love that you're talking about is to be loved for the work that you do, and people recognize you as being an expert. That fills an esteem need. And I think Maslow is talking more about companionship and social activity. I note also that many of the examples he gives for love refer to intimacy and sexual fulfillment. May not be exclusive to those two things, however, those are the examples he gives. When Dimitri was saying that in most workplaces the worker seek needs are met, I would say it depends. It depends on the context of the work. I was recently reading about emergency service workers and the risks they face doing their jobs. Safety is not a given for that kind of work. And there are some jobs like emergency medical service and coal mining, for example, that expose workers to significant risk. And in these kinds of work, the need for safety may be a much bigger motivator for people. I think where love and esteem needs cross is when you have groups such as the military or emergency medical services, where people have to depend on others for safety or to produce desired outcomes. Sports teams would be another good example. In these cases, there develops a strong social bond bordering on love or deep affection or camaraderie, because of the mutual dependency that people recognize exists between the members. This social connection and bond that people experience in the military or on elite sports teams is unlike anything experienced in more conventional work contexts. One of the things you see in the military is the strong connection or sense of camaraderie. It is partially fostered by the hierarchy and well-defined role structure. In most circumstances, you know or learn where you fit in the organization and what's expected of you right away. Leaders are granted a certain level of esteem and respect based on their job and rank. Now, that esteem will wax and wane based on actual performance over time, however. I think those are very strong motivators, the love and esteem. This is perhaps why many people who spend a lot of time in the military or elite sports teams can have great difficulty transitioning to more conventional work contexts. The strong personal connection that forms from intense focus on missions or the goal of achieving a championship aren't easy to duplicate in other settings. You're taught from your first days in the military that your life depends on others and their lives depend on you. This is reinforced constantly. It makes it hard for some people to personally manage the transition to other work. This really isn't addressed in the transition training that the military provides, so people have to manage it on their own.
Mm-hmm. That's a terrific point.
So yeah, that is interesting. However, I was more curious in, coming back to the point about that organizations are not all the same in terms of how long people spend in them. When you would go out to sea, the vessel with all the employees, let's say, would become a separate contained organization. And obviously they need to be kept motivated, as are you. So when you would go out to sea, how much of the pyramid would, would be used? Is it just maintaining the basic needs, or was there any strive to self-actualization by people on board a vessel that is detached for all intents and purposes from everyone else? I'm very curious about how that works out in organizations of this kind.
My experience is that the risk varies, and I do find this interesting. What happens at sea in particular areas of the ship where propulsion, electrical generation equipment is operating, these systems use high temperature, high energy fluids that carry significant risk for the people if they're not managed correctly or suffer certain kinds of failure. Navy trains a lot to combat the most likely failures to make sure the crew can handle them as safely as possible. I think that is a most interesting question, because I think it shows the hierarchy is adapted or temporarily reversed. Esteem becomes much less important than safety and food because of the risks and the teamwork necessary to manage them. The importance of food on Navy ships underway, and possibly any kind of ship underway, is an interesting thing. It goes beyond mere absence of hunger. When you're at sea on a ship, the quality of the food seems to be much more important. It becomes a major focus of your existence. I'm not sure why this is true or so, because I'm not a psychologist. I never really thought about it before you asked me. all of a sudden at sea, there can be a shift in the relative prepotency of needs because the context shifts. I imagine there are other kinds of work where this occurs. Maslow was, I think, referring to steady-state kinds of work where the context does not change significantly. The love and esteem and close connection between the workers is still very important, but they temporarily become less important, moving into the background behind safety and security. I think Maslow's theory can explain this. He also gives some examples that are similar, but we often don't talk about it, which is why I found that question so interesting and possibly causing me to ramble a bit in my response. Did I address your question sufficiently?
Yeah, but you didn't say what I thought you might, so it's even better.
What did you think?
One last thing is that on this point. So Maslow says that gratification becomes as important as deprivation.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that is true?
Well, I'm probably not qualified to claim that it's not true, but that's not been my experience. There are times when you're willing because of the nature of the work you do, through training, sometimes called overlearning, and socialization, where the gratification is more important in some circumstances than the deprivation. I think this means I actually agree with you, now that I think about it. I think this may be at odds with Maslow's basic theory because some of the situational determinants of what is important in the hierarchy crowd those out. You can have soldiers in combat or civilians in disasters that go for many days subsisting on little to eat because safety and security become much more salient, at least for short periods.
Okay, so I think I want to follow that more empirical direction that Ralph was going and reason a bit more, and I would love to see your inputs, guys, about that, on the applicability, if you will, of Maslow on today's low practices. Because I was thinking very hard in what are the points that you think that you see, you know, relevant and almost became common sense today. So one we talked about was this idea of, you know, giving some space, 20% or 10% of employees to do their own thing at work. But I think there are other couple of points. We also mentioned a bit about gratification, which if we think in relation to what you were saying before about Fayol and Taylor, is quite a powerful idea. You know, it's not only about sanctions, it's also about incentives and gratification. So it's a very common HRM policy, I think, nowadays. But there were another couple of things that came to mind to me. One, I think has to do with the allocation of personnel. He talks about this thing, you know, about you should put individuals in things that they are very fitted for. You know, he doesn't say necessarily about work, but, you know, individuals should be in place that they are fitted and they feel they contribute and they feel, you know, well there. So I think it relates to this idea of, you know, if you have a matrix organization, for instance, and you have to sparse people across different projects, and I think this relates to this thing of the shifts that we're talking about, you know, in which kind of missions you send people and what's going to fit different for different people. What's your views on that?
So one comment I have about relevance, and that is, I just started thinking about, based on what Pedro said, about the safety, security in the hierarchy of going off to esteem and self-actualization, which is, I think, where a lot of companies say they want their workers in this fully developing themselves and becoming more effective at what they do in the organization. So maybe that's the organizational sense of self-actualization. One of the things that strikes me about that thinking in today's workplace is I don't see a lot of emphasis addressing employees' job-related safety and security needs. So you'll see companies do massive downsizing or big layoffs, and it almost puts the employees in this sense of shock. And in fact, there's been some studies that I've heard about that it's almost like people go through post-traumatic stress disorder because of this sense of shock they have of losing the connection to the people that they knew. Mm-hmm. And so I think that some of those, you can have these jolts to the system that either throw you back some levels or reverses the hierarchy. Maslow says several times, in a good society, these kind of safety needs are taken care of. And I would say in organizations, that's often not so because of the dynamic events that go on in organizations. So that's one thing about relevance that occurred to me.
For me, one of the things that stands out when we speak of allocation of personnel and sort of applying the whole theory of motivation to the workplace is how on earth do you do that? If we speak of things like pursuing self-actualization or even other slightly lower needs, these are deeply personal, I think. So how is it that you're supposed to identify and actualize these needs in an organized collective way?
I think, at least the company I was studying for the PhD, you know, this big engineering company, since it's the kind of place that people tend to stay for a long time, it's a kind of old school long-term employment place, they have like official personal development plans that every year people sit down with their manager, says what they think they get feedback from the supervisors, they say what they see themselves becoming more advanced in the technical track or the managerial track, and their suggestions of course they might do, and, you know, kind of projects they would like to be engaged. So I think there is some kind of, you know, way to keep track of that.
I can agree with you, although I want to go back to what Dimitri said, because I think he had made a really interesting point that I really hadn't thought about till he said it. And that was this idea that in the general theory, Maslow portrays the sort of the lower level needs, so maybe below self-esteem, as kind of standard ways to satisfy those things. You know, for example, you just get food and then you're done. You know, that's you have enough food in. And Dimitri made the point, which I thought was excellent, that there's more individualism in those, in satisfying those basic needs than we might think. And therefore, it becomes very difficult to say if we make sure that, for example, that Pedro has bologna and white bread sandwiches, is that going to take care of his, you know, is that going to take care of his hunger? For to use sort of a trivial example, whereas mm-hmm. you know, whereas if and you, I think you talked about earlier, Pedro, we were talking about it kind of depends on how you're raised and what your background is and stuff. And so, if you were raised yeah. to really yeah. value food and the differences in food, and yet yes. I'm you know, I'm more American, so you know, meat and potatoes, and that's all I really care about, which is not true, by the way. Then we're going to have sort of different approaches to that. By analogy, you could say, well, that's going to make it difficult in organizations to say, how do we satisfy the safety or esteem needs from people or some of these other, those lower levels, the you know more foundational aspects of the hierarchy. So I thought that was a really interesting point that, that Dimitri has said, because I'm not sure if people have thought through that.
That's true.
Well, I think unless you're as committed as Google, you probably normally fall to the lowest common denominator. And maybe not, but I have a very vivid, somewhat traumatic experience of that. Before going into academia, when I was working in underwater technology, I spent about a month on this boat where they would serve the same plastic spaghetti every day for lunch. And even after a week, no amount of ketchup or any other seasonings would make it. Basically, the meal was something you had to do because you needed the energy. And even then, it was done very, very quickly and to almost taking the plaster off. So,
on this note, I just want to say to Ralph that I prefer sandwiches with cream cheese and salmon and rocket salad instead of bologna and whatever.
Okay, that's good. And I think Dimitris just helped me make my point even better in that you got an organization there that, sure, maybe they're way to the other end of the spectrum from Google, and yet they're not even considering any value added by some differentiation. Because I will tell you, on submarines, basically do not come up above the surface. And so you basically don't look out the window. You don't see mountains. You don't see sunrise. You don't see sunset. The Navy's view is that food is very, very important. So it's not just purely a satisfaction need to be met. It's a very important motivator and contributes greatly to your general attitude towards work. I think Dimitris gave a great example of a company that doesn't see it that way, and which may be acceptable for if it's menial labor, right? We were talking about those differences.
I think I have a hard question. I was wondering, our discussion, we are trying to think Maslow inside organizational theory, and he has been used there. But I was wondering, are we actually forcing him somewhere that he doesn't belong? Because, I mean, I don't know if he says explicitly that you're supposed to get fulfillment in all these needs at work or from work. So maybe we keep thinking, you know, can we stretch it? Is it okay? Does it fit?
Yes. I think there is one aspect that we are overlooking. That is the fact that Maslow was a psychologist. So his work was definitely more of a general nature, and it was conceptualized in order to be applied to a wide variety of settings. While actually what we are doing is carrying it to only one context, the organizational one, the workplace. And this definitely may be the source of many issues.
I think you may be right about that. And I think perhaps what we suffer from in organizational theory, or maybe it's the way it's applied, maybe it's not organizational theory, is that I wouldn't say stretching Maslow too far. I would say maybe homogenizing it so much to make it easy to understand. Remember, I think it was Miranda, somebody was saying, we've lost some of that nuance of Maslow. When you read him, what he actually wrote, you say, oh, okay, this is sort of a general guide. And yet that's often not the way it's applied or taught to people. It's more like, okay, here's this hierarchy and you have to get all these things done before you go to... But I mean, it wasn't until I read this text that I think I understood, and maybe I was taught this, I just don't remember, that I understood that you could have these percentages and the percentages can vary amongst individuals and you can have some of these things swap around. That's why I really enjoyed having a chance to read the original, actually for the first time.
Me too. That was the first time I read it.
Well, the percentages bit is something that I really like, and that's something that really frustrates me at the same time. On one hand, it's a relief to find out that it's not this mechanistic step-by-step ladder to self-actualization, which is something I want to talk about later still. But on the other hand, if it's percentages and if it's a mixture, which makes sense, how does this hierarchy help us in any possible way? How is this an improvement on James's thing that I mentioned about material, social, and spiritual. What's the point? If it's percentages, which he doesn't describe, by the way, there's no formula. He just says arbitrarily that if it's 60% of basic needs, maybe you can get 20% of the safety needs and that sort of thing. Basically, why?
Well, I'm not sure I could speak for anybody else or why organizations, others might find this useful. But I think there is value, even though, as you said, Maslow's not the first one to look at these sort of dimensions, these sort of different dimensions of people, so let's start with Taylor, and you say, okay, well, Taylor is looking from an engineering process point of view and just saying, okay, people come to work and they want to get paid and we'll very precisely define the work. And then we looked at Fayol, and Fayol was talking more about how managers should approach this sort of top-down approach to organizing the work. So I think Maslow was, for me anyway, it's a nice, and that's why I kind of like the order. I don't know who the brilliant person was that came up with the order, but of the readings, but I like the way now we're trying to say, well, there's more to it than that. And these people have these needs, and there tends to be this hierarchy, although Maslow talks about how it's not a one-size-fits-all model for all, and there's ways the percentages can vary. So I would say, as a prelude to that, as a manager, that means you do have to pay attention to, you know, what's going on in people's lives. So here's a practical example. In naval aviation, they realize that if you are having domestic problems at home or you have a sick child, your mind is not going to be on the highest skill levels. And so a form of that is self-actualization. The highest skill levels as a pilot, you will be distracted as a pilot. And therefore, they actually have ways of evaluating those kinds of things in a non-punitive way. And they will pull people off of flight duty. It's called a flight status. So they'll take you out of flight status if you're going through very difficult problems at home, or you're, you know, like you had a relative just die or something like that. And I've seen that in other parts of the Navy where we tried to actually account for that. So I think in perhaps more enlightened is not the best way to say it, but in some organizations you realize you're dealing with whole people. People aren't just showing up for a paycheck every day. And I think people respond to that. They don't necessarily want their manager involved in all their personal details, but they respond to that kind of willingness of organizations to look at them as more nuanced. So that's why I think that's one way you can apply Maslow.
I just want to build on that. It's a great point and go back to what Dimitri was saying. I don't know his or her thought as well as you do, Dimitri, but don't you think that he's in a way adding meat to this idea, and which is powerful because then it has been so successful and has been taken up by organizational theory. So maybe that's his contribution there.
Well, perhaps. I mean, I'm not disputing the value of these ideas, and I'm certainly not saying that we would have been just as well off had he not formulated this theory. I guess my concern, and it's a minor concern, so I guess I don't want to dwell too much on it, is given that there is pretty much no empirical substantiation to this work, and there doesn't seem to be a tremendous amount of conceptual substantiation either, because thinking of what makes people tick has been going on since recorded history of thought, pretty much. Why is this work so popular?
Well, I will tell you, because I was taught this as an undergraduate at the Naval Academy, and so one of the attractions is it's a nice, clear, crisp model. You can talk about these stages that people go through, and it's fairly easy to convey if you take out all the nuance that Maslow used. So like Taylor, right? Maslow can be misused or misrepresented just focusing on the stages and saying, well, I'm done. You have these stages, so take care of everything else, and here you go off into self-actualization. And so I think I think it's the way Maslow's been interpreted and used is what makes it so attractive to people. That's just my guess.
I don't know so much how he became so popular and why, but I think for me it's important because it's a strong counter-argument to so many other basic theories, you know, that it's everything about pay or basic axioms that we have imported from economics, such as that individuals are these maximizing machines, they all want the same thing over and over, which is more money and more profit. He breaks that. He says that as I was saying before, there's this, there's layers, so it's not about the same thing that people want more. And the things that they want is not necessarily this individual thing. This is usually profit that would read as money, but also there's more social benefits, if you will. So I think it's a strong voice against, you know, this canon.
Well, maybe just maybe I'm reading a bit too much into it and seeing a story where there actually isn't one, but it could be that Maslow's hierarchy is so popular and attractive because it actually tells a kind of from rags to riches stories. So if we remember Maslow's biography, he goes from being the son of Jewish immigrants to a university professor. And these kind of stories where we overcome challenges and make our way in life towards our ultimate achievements, they've always had a good level of fascination.
That's a good point, because I think that connects to what Dimitri was saying earlier. Yes. About the connection with Viktor Frankl, which is a sort of a similar idea. And I think Miranda makes a really good point. Mm-hmm. When she talks about this climbing up the stages thing, because, you know, when you read, it's hard, at least I found it hard, when you're reading about esteem and self-actualization, it's hard not to look at it and say, yeah, that's where I want to be. That's, you know, I want to be the self-actualizing person, right? So there's this sort of aspirational aspect to it where I think Maslow maybe in some ways democratizes this, everybody can have this higher calling or this higher purpose. And that'd be one reason why it's very attractive to people.
Well, this is actually something that's unclear, what you just said, Ralph, because he writes on page 10, third paragraph from bottom, last sentence, what a man can be, he must be, right?
Yeah, I agree. I wrote that down.
Yeah. So What is this determinism that we're dealing with? What does it mean that what a man can be, he must be? Is it... All right, so two things are here at play for me. One is there some kind of a metaphysical trajectory where each individual is going, and then actualizing this trajectory is sort of the function of the hierarchy of needs, right? So is Pedro... Pedro is, for instance, destined to become a great sociologist, so that is what he is kind of going for. That is his form in this terrestrial existence. Or
I'm rooting for
you. Let's hope so.
Or is it that in a looser way, that what a man can be in terms of finding a meaningful outlet, a skill set, and certain capabilities that this man or woman may have, then they must strive to this to fulfill this, mm-hmm. to find meaning in their life and work. And if it's the latter, then I think our mentioning of Viktor Frankl is extremely interesting, because I don't know if we all read Man's Search for Meaning, but if you go through that book, and we'll attach it in show notes, is you notice that whilst there's significant deprivation in basic needs, especially in safety, and needs such as self-esteem are completely out the window, he does describe how people manage to self-actualize. So it's not even that mm-hmm. all the levels of the pyramid are there, and the ones that are certainly used in a different proportion than to what he tries to suggest.
I don't know much about Viktor Frankl, but I want to go back to what you said about the sentence, you know, what man can be, must be. I think it's actually very interesting because, I mean, it's all... Who is to decide? That's your point, I think. You know, is the person to decide? And what about when the person can be well into different positions? You gave my example. So my supervisor usually jokes that I love bacon. I usually bake and bring things, you know, to the office. That's, you know, should I be a baker or a sociologist? But if you think in companies, you know, if someone is very good in management and is very good in the more technical things, should he go or she go to the more administrative career? Should go to technical career? So that's a difficult. So is the organization they want to decide? Is the person they want to decide?
Well, even beyond that, not just who would decide, but how do you know?
Yes. I mean, I think I think there's a bit of a paradox there, right? Because, and I think you bring up a really interesting way of looking at it. So there's this idea, there's sort of this deterministic aspect. If you look at a strong interpretation of the what man can be, he must be, right? With that, because I read the same thing and thought, mm-hmm. must, you know, what does that really mean? That he will be forever unhappy if they're not, you know, if the person's not developing themselves, or there'll be a source of dissatisfaction. And then he talks later about the need to develop mm-hmm. one's skills, and I think that relates back to the self-esteem and the need for admiration or social connection with other people. And so I think it's a bit of both. I think there are, mm-hmm. so I think for some people, yes, there's the, we were talking about creativity earlier, or maybe entrepreneurs, right? So what a man can be or a woman can be, they must be, and they have this strong, intense desire. And then I think there's others for whom it's, I'm not saying it's not the same. I think it's not the same. I don't think the motivation is the same. And I think you can interpret Maslow that way. I just think mm-hmm. in that one sentence, that was a very strong way to say it. So I think that only applies, and based on my personal experience, you know, to a small number of people. because I think he talks about, I forget where in the text, about the courage and confidence people have to overcome obstacles, you know, those kinds of things. And so, yes, some people have that, but not everyone.
Yeah. So let's expand on that. So the question could be, are all employees to be motivated? Is motivation essential?
So what do you mean, motivation in the workplace?
Should we care about that?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's as well.
Yeah.
You know, I don't. Maybe that's too strong a way to say it. But certainly for people who are going to become more self-actualized or, you know, develop in their potential, like you were talking about earlier about the people that the development conversation people had to have with their managers. If you're not motivated, and certainly a lot of your basic needs are fulfilled, it will be difficult for you. I'm not saying it won't be possible. It's just, I think that complicates things. And so I think motivation is important. But it goes back to what Dimitri said. A lot of that's very individualistic. And so what motivates one person isn't going to motivate another. And that's what makes it difficult to apply Maslow in organizations. Because if you say, here's the hierarchy and I'll take care of these things this way. Dimitri made that excellent point about, those are very individualistic things. And it may not be motivating for everybody.
So it's not just that. It's also, as you said, and as you illustrated with the going to see example, that this cocktail of needs changes based on circumstances.
Yes, absolutely.
The only thing I was wondering is that, you know, I was trying to make, you know, like a point just out there so I could like get to what I really want to get is that how we're supposed to deal with boredom then, you know, because you think about many repetitive tasks. I'm not talking about knowledge workers, refined engineers, professionals, any people that do a very repetitive task every day, day after other. It's normal they'll be bored. So how are you going to conceptualize that in Maslow's ideas? You know, it doesn't fit there?
Well, you should not feed them as much and keep them not as safe.
Well, it's a really good point, Pedro. And I think that a part of what you see in modern organizations, is particularly amongst knowledge workers, is this idea that not only do you have to have varied experiences to develop expertise, but you actually, it's necessary, helpful to sustain motivation, right? Because giving the people a changing cocktail, as Dimitri likes to say, of projects and things that tap into needs differently, that may be a way of saying, well, we don't know exactly what motivates you, but we're going to try these different things or give you these different projects to help you tap into those things.
Yeah.
Well, it may be fulfilling.
But what about cashiers in supermarkets?
Shouldn't generalize certain occupations as inherently boring, but I can see how someone would be happy doing that for human interaction, for instance, and that might be
okay. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, so I will speak from experience. I worked as a waiter when in my undergrad in Italy, and I completely hated it. You know, it was interesting at first and interesting sometimes, but most of the time I was just bored. So
yeah, that's a good question.
So was it in terms of the hierarchy? So, you know, did you hate it when you got the paycheck so you could eat?
No, I think hate is a strong word, but let's put it, I was bored for the most part. So that's my point.
Well, and that's interesting because that shows that what your calling was or what you felt you wanted to do wasn't actually touched very well or connected by the level of self-actualization that was possible, right? Because you can imagine a spectrum of tasks and capabilities as a waiter. And some people, when you go out, they have the waiter's wait staff or the server is very engaging and they seem to really enjoy what they're doing. And so for some people, that may be their level of self-actualization, that this idea that they're connected with their customers' needs and they're empathetic and, you know, those kinds of things. Because you can always tell, you have a tendency to be able to tell, and I'm sure particularly in your case, Pedro, when the waiter just really isn't very motivated, it's just going through the motions kind of mechanistically, whereas somebody who really tries to engage with you and has a engaging and effervescent personality it's a whole different experience with a server. So I think in that case, it didn't tap into what you needed.
The man you could be was beyond what the occupation enabled you to. So you became a waiter, I think, and then you couldn't go above that. Maybe that's one way of thinking about it.
Yeah. So can I make one point about that? So there now I can see what the man can be, he must be, right? Or what the person can be, they must be. Because there's a case where Pedro identified he needed to be something else. That was not what he needed to be, and therefore he felt that drive to do something else. So now I can see that a little bit better.
I think not as a standalone framework and certainly not as a prescriptive framework. It certainly does well, I think, as we just illustrated, to describe in retrospect why something may or may not have worked out. But I was just thinking about when we did Taylor, we stumbled upon this caveat where he would not necessarily fire people when they could form a job, but try to move them elsewhere within the organization. And I'm also really itching to tell about this Ardit theory that probably shouldn't go into at this point, the stratified systems theory, that basically does the same thing, that identifying what job position you're best suited for as an individual. So I think there is value in terms of learning lessons of the past, but I don't know how much this could be used as an organizational design tool, as I think it has been misused in this way.
Well, so I would say in the Navy, U.S. Navy, we do try to use it as a to guide organizational design or development, maybe, because we do create positions or have the opportunity to create positions where you can see if somebody is not, their self-actualization needs are not being met in the current role. You have the flexibility to create new roles for them, and I think that's where there's some, because Maslow doesn't really address, go into detail, which is not a criticism. I think it just wasn't the purpose of his writing. That there's a, in the self-actualization aspect of it, I believe, and there's some writing about this, that it's a journey of self-discovery. You don't wake up one day and say, oh, I want to be, this is the kind of person I want to be. You're actually discovering it in the flow of events. And I think that's kind of what Pedro, discovered, being a waiter and doing these kinds of activities. And it's all very interesting at first. And then you realize, okay, this is as high as I can go in this kind of activity, and it's not where I want to be. And so you're discovering more. I think you learned a lot about yourself in that kind of position. And then what you see in the organization is there are not many other roles for you other than a manager or something like that, because you have a very flat organization with a few people in hierarchy. And if there's already a manager, you may not be able to step into something like that. Whereas in the Navy or in other organizations, they try to be able to create positions for people.
I agree with all that, but I think my point is also that, some people do not have the choice. I mean, I was just in the waitering while I was doing my undergrad, so it was fine. I knew it was not going to make my
whole
life. But
okay,
for other people that worked with me, it was. And they were bored as well. So sometimes, structurally, you don't have the choice to pursue what you feel that you would like and everything else. So reality hits you.
Well, I think that's where the courage comes in and all those attributes, that Maslow wants you to take your destiny by the horns and, pursue it. I think that's also in concert with what Miranda said about Maslow's personal background.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I want to make a comment about my understanding of entrepreneurship, right? What you see.
That fit.
So many studies of entrepreneurship is it's a strong personal drive these people have to create and, develop new things and be inventive and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there's not a large fraction of the population that have that kind of courage and that energy and that zeal to do those kinds of things. So I think in many ways entrepreneurship is like, well, I know I'm changing the subject slightly, but I thought it would be fun to do that. It's like artistry, right? Okay. This same kind of desire to create and do something new, because you get these people that are serial entrepreneurs that try to do, start many companies.
That's actually a bit of a tricky point in the sense that it's a bit difficult to fit Maslow's hierarchy to entrepreneurship, especially because the studies in this field have mainly been concerned with showing why and how entrepreneurs are a different category of individuals, a category which needs to be set aside from others such as managers. So in this sense, the hierarchy probably needs to be adapted, especially because there are actually a wide range of motives which drive entrepreneurs to set up their own businesses. And this goes from ideas of autonomy and independence to risk orientation or to just the will to realize their own ideas in the shape of products and services.
Great point, because on the one hand, Maslow seems to be operating in the ideal type of this great person who would strive to fulfill their true being and be courageous in the process of doing that. But on the other hand, as you just pointed out, we all know of stories of these great entrepreneurs who would forego basic needs for the sake of, running their business. So do you get the sense that this framework is sort of paradoxical in this way, that it's supposed to be general and yet it doesn't apply to its inspiration?
I mean he talks about in the text a bit that some people are
it's made out as a caveat
in light of others.
This is possible,
but of course
it's not the cornerstone of the theory. which I think maybe it should be.
Yeah, maybe that's what's missing. Yeah. I'll just give you the example of Van Gogh, and he would like not eat because he was the poor painter and so on and so forth. That he was, like, story says, you know, rumor has it that he would not eat sometimes just to be able to paint and buy, you know, the materials and everything. So,
That's actually great. It's not just him. There's also in theology, there's these mystical branches or religions where people would deliberately forego basic needs with the intent to self-actualize. So the ascetics, the early Christian ascetics, they would go out into the desert and basically survive on breadcrumbs of that in order to obtain this spiritual experience that would, I think, be of the self-actualizing value for them. Well, these are extreme cases, right? But I think they're warranted because he mentions this. He, in describing why the basic needs are such that he identified the food, water, sex, which is an odd one to be in there, but I guess depends on the individual. So when designating these needs as basic, he does talk about the extreme case of where someone deprived of food would only think of food and eating. So whilst it is extreme, and as I mentioned before, that we don't really come across such situations of extreme deprivation in our everyday lives, it's certainly there. So what's the main thing that we took away from this text?
I got a similar thing. I didn't think so much about the percentage, but it was the same direction. That for me was interesting that there is no pyramid actually. And what is for me, he's really saying is that people are these social beings that have this need for fulfillment, that they require differences in kind, not of degree. So we cannot give the same thing, money or anything that it is for people, and that would be enough. So that for me is the take home lesson.
I think the main takeaway of this reading is given by the centrality of the individual, which in this case is conceptualized as a set of needs that in turn drive our behavior and guide our decisions.
For me, I think I'm still hung up whole trajectory of where this pyramid is pointing to, whether it's search for meaning or whether it's this more deterministic thing. And that's probably just because of where I am in terms of my what I'm reading. But other than that, I'm glad we read it, and I'm glad I'm not going to have to read it again, because whilst I agree with all the points that you made, and it hasn't been the most exciting text to read. And I think in terms of value that I got out of reading it, so far out of the three that we did, it's probably the lowest levels. But certainly something to go through. I mean, it's only like 20 pages long. And given what we come to learn about Maslow and the pyramid, it's definitely worth having a look at, I think. And that concludes episode 3 on the theory of human motivation. Thank you for listening. Next time we are going to do something a little bit different. Instead of reading one text and discussing it as we have done these past 3 episodes, we are going to look at the origins of the concept of organizational routines by reading 2 books, one by Simon and March and one by Syed and March, and both from what is now known as the Carnegie Mellon School of Management tradition. For more information on these, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and look out for supplements to episode 4 next week, where our very first and very special guest, Katharina, talks about the readings and about how they relate to one another. If you enjoyed this episode and like our podcast, please tell your friends and colleagues about us. Get in touch on Twitter and Facebook to tell us what you think, and leave a review on iTunes. Even a brief review can help new listeners find us there. Thank you for joining us, and I hope to see you next time as we look at the Carnegie Mellon School of Management with a special focus on organizational routines.